loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met yesterday with senior North Korean official Kim Jong-chol to discuss the possible summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. Pompeo released no substantive information after the meetings, and pundits said the summit was no closer to happening than it was before the meetings. Meanwhile, Kim Jong-chol delivered a letter from Kim Jong-un to President Trump today. Next, political chaos reigns in the periphery of the Eurozone. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy was ousted in a parliamentary vote of no confidence. He was replaced by socialist Pedro Sanchez. And in Italy, an unorthodox mix of populist characters takes office, led by Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, a law professor who has been accused of embellishing his resume. Then President Trump yesterday demanded that U.S. allies, quote, fix trade, unquote, in the immediate aftermath of new tariffs on goods coming from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said that the U.S. and Canada were very near a renegotiated trade deal yesterday when Vice President Pence suddenly demanded that any new deal automatically expire after 5 years. The Canadians walked away. And then, when 167 schools closed in Puerto Rico a little more than a year ago, it was a painful sign that the island's economy had not recovered from a long recession. But when another 265 schools closed soon after that, it sent the entire education system into a state of turmoil. Why does Puerto Rico's education system not function the way it should? And finally, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Korea. President Trump announced this afternoon that his June 12th summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is back on. It'll be held in Singapore. The president spoke with senior North Korean leader Kim Jong-chol after the North Korean held talks with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo earlier today. We're joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. She's an anti-war activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink. Medea has been in Korea recently, where she was meeting with other peace activists. Medea, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So it's a news-filled day today. The president gave an off-the-top-of-his-head talk. I don't know if we could call it a press conference, but he seemed to be saying all the right things, that the relationships are building, that this is very positive, that the North Koreans want to denuclearize, they want to develop. Where do you think this is going?
And most importantly, he said the June 12th summit is on.
It is on.
He said, we'll see you in Singapore. So that's been touch and go, Medea. Last week, President Trump canceled the summit. But then Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un met at the DMZ and got things going again. Anyway, what's your take? Big news.
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, I think it's great that the summit is back on. I think we've got to really understand how much the president of South Korea is responsible for this. Although I must say, when we were in South Korea was when Trump said it was off. And what we had heard was that it was the North Koreans reaching out to the South saying, let's meet, let's get this back on. And they met immediately. It was quite remarkable. I mean, here you have two countries in North and South that is had so little communication for the last decade. And then all of a sudden, you know, one of them can pick up the phone and call the other one, and they meet at the DMZ. In fact, while we were having our peace walk, they were meeting right by at Panmunjom. So things have changed tremendously. Our sense was that from the communications and the support on the peninsula, that the peace train has left the station, that the people in the peninsula are demanding that there be a peace process, and that Trump is coming along with it. And so it's exciting. It's great. And I think, unlike a lot of Democrats who had poo-pooed the whole effort and said that Trump was not ready for this, I think everybody's ready for this in the sense that it's been 70 years, and it's time for both denuclearization and a peace process to happen at the same time.
Yeah, Trump seemed to indicate in his comments right outside the White House after Kim Jong-chol, the North Korean general, drove away in with his entourage, that at the June 12th summit, it wasn't going to be done all at once. He said, this is the beginning of a process. It's going to be a long process. Now, that's important because up until now, you had John Bolton and Mike Pence using the language of complete, irreversible, comprehensive denuclearization on the part of North Korea. And North Korea was saying, well, look, this has to be synchronized. It has to be reciprocal. It has to be step by step. They're not going to come in and give away everything without anything in return. And the precondition for the North Koreans has been from the beginning, that there must be an end to the policy of extreme hostility from the United States towards the DPRK. That's their precondition. And what I think we heard Donald Trump saying it in his own Donald Trump way is, yes, this is going to be a phased long-term process. In other words, the U.S. is now moving into an understanding of the DPRK negotiating position and accepting it, something John Bolton and Mike Pence certainly didn't want to do. But that is the precondition for this to go forward, it seems to me anyway. Go ahead, Medea.
Well, right. This is a long process, a complicated process. You don't get out of 70 years of hostility with one meeting. And, of course, the North is going to be concerned about all the U.S. bases in the South, the 28,000 Americans who are there, the military exercises that go on several times a year, the nuclear umbrella. I mean, all of this has to come into the discussion. And so it is going to be a long discussion. And I think, you know, from our sense being in South Korea, it really is amazing the sea change in the South that has been used to the demonization of the North. And suddenly, it seemed like almost overnight, there is now a favorable opinion of Moon Jae-in. It seems like suddenly the people are realizing this is somebody that, I said between Moon and Kim Jong-un, that these are people who can talk to each other. These are people who can understand each other. That Kim Jong-un is actually not a crazy man, that he is sophisticated. What we heard many times, people saying, oh, he has good manners. We didn't know he had good manners. He is winning over the hearts and minds of people who have hated him for decades. And that's something quite interesting. They also said that that North Korea has shown a number of gestures, concrete gestures, of releasing American prisoners, of blowing up nuclear facility. What is Trump doing? And they wanted to see some gestures from the part of Donald Trump as well. And so this is going to be not only a long process, but a process where the U.S. has to understand Korean culture, reciprocity, respect, and during these negotiations be on a give and a take. And if it seems like Trump does want to show the world that he can negotiate, he's going to have to be very clear that there are going to be many things that the U.S. is going to have to give in along the way.
Yeah, that's the voice of Medea Benjamin. Medea just got back from the DMZ, where she was part of a very, very large peace delegation. I think, Medea, it was mainly or maybe exclusively women. Is that correct?
Yes, it was 30 women from 15 different countries, a fantastic delegation. And among the recommendations, if I could just throw out, of short-term things that we are recommending Trump do, one is to start intersection, you know, which is the precursor to embassies, to open up the line of communication, to lift the U.S. travel ban so people can go to North Korea, as you know, Brian, we used to be able to do, and to show a humanitarian gesture by the U.S. giving funds for the UNICEF and other UN calls for humanitarian aid to North Korea. Those are some small goodwill gestures that Trump could take.
No, that's a very good start. As Medea has pointed out, the DPRK unilaterally has taken several measures. They unilaterally declared a moratorium on their nuclear weapons test, moratorium on their missile technology test. Moratorium, they released the three American detainees in North Korean jails. and they unilaterally destroyed their own nuclear test site with the media present. Yes, what the North Koreans are looking for is reciprocity. And Donald Trump suggested, he said, this war has gone on too long. It's gone on almost 70 years. We want to talk about an agreement to end the war. Now, well, without saying that explicitly, Medea, that would be an extremely important signal to North Korea, because the DPRK has for a long time said there must be a peace treaty ending the Korean War. There's only an armistice agreement now, and that armistice was signed, 65 years ago. Time to end the Korean War. Maybe that would be where we're going at the June 12th summit discussion in a practical way about normalizing relations.
Well, yes, and I think that's where President Moon of South Korea comes in, because he understands that the denuclearization of the North has to go hand in hand with the peace process that the North needs. And so thank goodness the people rose up in South Korea and put somebody in power who was absolutely dedicated to this process. And I think June 12th will be very historic.
All right. We're going to leave it there, John. A very exciting moment for Korea. Big, big, big news.
We may be on the brink of something really great here. We were joined from Washington by Medea Benjamin. Medea is an anti-war activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink. And she just returned from Korea, where she was meeting with other peace activists. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, in studio with my co-host, Brian Becker. Political chaos reigns on the periphery of the Eurozone today. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy was ousted in a parliamentary vote of no confidence. He was replaced by socialist Pedro Sanchez. And in Italy, an unorthodox mix of populist characters takes office, led by Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, a law professor who has been accused of embellishing his resume. We are joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and this show's producer, Walter Smolarek. Welcome to both of you.
Nice to be here.
Happy to be here.
Dick, let's start with Spain. This is the first time in the history of the European Union that two countries have replaced their leadership in the same day. And this was a long time coming. Rajoy gave a very heartfelt speech on the floor of parliament, saying what an honor it was to have been prime minister. And Pedro Sanchez gave a very passionate speech talking about how he wanted to change Spain. So where do you think this is going in the coming days and weeks?
Well, I think that's a very hard question to actually answer, because the Socialist Party, Pedro Sanchez's party's government, has only got 84 seats in the 350-seat parliament. They ousted Rajoy because of the final decision in a big corruption case here. And basically the sentiment was such in the country that if the Socialist Party hadn't moved this motion, then Podemos, the more radical left force, would have moved such a motion. And all parties really that were not on the right, and that includes the Basque Nationalist Party, had to vote for this. But there's no even sizable minority on which to base a government. And the right wing is determined to make life very, very difficult for the PSOE, and they've got weapons that they can do that with. So it's not at all easy to say what will happen. Sanchez is making noises about consulting with all the other parties. There are a number of resolutions that they can pass where there's a majority support, mainly to cut back the restrictive nature of the gag law that we've got here, to increase pensions and various other things like that. But this is nothing like a program for government.
You know, I was interested to see too that this group that ousted Rajoy was really a patchwork of parties and independent ideologies. You mentioned the Basques, for example. There were five or six Basque MPs that voted no in the vote of no confidence. There were Catalonian Republicans. There were really groups from all around the country. But you don't think that's going to hold? That's not a strong enough coalition to govern?
It's a coalition to get rid of Rajoy. It's not a coalition with a coherent program for government. I mean, we should remember that just 2 weeks ago, Sanchez himself was attacking the new Catalan parliament, a new Catalan administration, calling them supremacist and racist, saying that the law against rebellion should be amended and brought up to date so that it could be used against Catalan separatism. So that was just 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, there was competition between Sanchez, Rajoy and Citizens, a new sort of new right party here, to see who could be harder on the Catalans. So what you have now is a sort of promise of dialogue from Sanchez towards the Catalan parties, but we'll see how far that can go, because anything that really makes some decent concessions to the Catalan case for self-determination will produce an almighty reaction from the right wing and from the establishment, which is, of course, more than the parties. It's the media, it's the monarchy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very hard to see what space for manoeuvre Sanchez has got. He's got some space for manoeuvre on the national question, and he can use the fact that this worsening of relations between Catalonia and the central Spanish administration has taken place under the Rajoy government, so he can blame it all on the Rajoy government. But he doesn't have a huge space to manoeuvre in. I should say one other thing, which is that this result is the result of the absolute disgust in the Spanish population as a whole with the level of corruption in the PP government. That's the real reason this government fell. In Spain, you have two basic blocks. One block is the right wing, which is Spanish centralist. The other block is the broad left, which includes Spanish centralist forces like the PSOE and the various national minorities. And so it's much harder to get a consistent program and agreement on a left nationalist basis than it is amongst the right.
Walter, let's turn for a minute to Italy, too. Yeah, this government was something like 2 hours old when the new Prime Minister Conte announced that his government's ultimate goal on immigration is to deport everybody who's undocumented in Italy. So what are we looking at now in Italy over the coming months or perhaps year?
Right. That's a very important question, because when you read the mainstream news, you know, of course, the only thing that they're talking about is like the Eurozone common currency, and, you know, the economic situation, the economic stability of Europe, which of course is like a very major issue that deserves to be talked about. But to me, I think the most dangerous part about this new government is that Matteo Salvini, the head of the League Party, which used to be known as the Northern League, he's an extreme far right anti-immigrant, you know, xenophobe, I think it would certainly be accurate to call him. He's going to be the interior minister, which means that he's going to be in charge basically of the armed, you know, the internal security forces of the Italian government. And so, you know, he's promised to set up detention centers all throughout Italy to carry out these mass roundups of immigrants. And so I think, you know, that would be something that really heightens dramatically the level of racism in Italy, something that is going to terrorize a big part of the population. So I think that angle is very important to bring out as well, Matteo Salvini becoming the interior minister.
And I'm wondering also what this does about the Eurozone. These populist parties in Italy have been very clear that they don't like the euro, they don't want to stay in the euro, and they want to go back to the lira. Is that realistic?
Well, I think that they've softened their position a bit when it comes to the euro common currency. I mean, you know, at the time when Italy was entering the euro common currency, I'm sure all these people would be, you know, opposed to it. But now that it's in the common currency, they, while I think, you know, maybe in their heart of hearts do prefer a return to the lira, the question is, you know, how can that actually practically be managed in the third largest economy in the Eurozone, in Italy, which, you know, is struggling with pretty high levels of debt, pretty high levels of unemployment. You know, it's definitely considered to be one of the weaker economies in the Eurozone. And so on that basis, I think that they may try to get some types of concessions from Brussels, from the European Union bureaucracy, which really is politically led by Germany at this point. But a full exit from the Eurozone, I think, is something that would there would have to be several other things that would take us in that direction.
Dick, what does the change in government in Spain mean in terms of debt servicing and the Spanish economy? Do you see any changes happening there?
Hard to say in the short run. Of course, there is immediate, a panic of artificially induced panic, fall in the stock exchange index here, increase in the premium on Spanish government debt. But all this will depend very much on what this government actually does in the economy. I don't think there's going to be anything remarkably new in the short run, because they've, in order to get the Basque Nationalist Party to agree to vote out Rajoy, they had to agree to the adoption of the budget, which was only adopted a week ago, the Rajoy government budget, which the Socialist Party voted against, but the Basque Nationalist Party voted for and actually got through. They did that because they got a huge present in the form of $500 million in infrastructure funding. So Sanchez had to promise that. This means the sort of fiscal policy parameters are set. There are other things that they can do, but it's likely that they'll try and follow a kind of Portuguese line, which is a slightly less Austerian policy, a slightly more restrictive, less restrictive policy. And if they also do something a little bit courageous and go after tax evasion, then there's parameters within the rules that are set from Brussels for them to have a slightly more expansionary policy without provoking an economic crisis. But I don't want to sort of predict anything on that. But I'm just saying that there's space for manoeuvre there, precisely because the PP government didn't want to go after its mates who were the big tax evaders, and a new government could do that. As I say, along the lines of what happened in Portugal after the Socialist Party was elected there.
Walter, we've only got about 45 seconds left, and this is going to be a question that's probably too difficult to answer in 45 seconds, but do you see any major changes coming vis-a-vis the European Union because of these two elections?
Well, one thing in the long term that they're considering is what's being referred to as a two-speed Europe, where there's sort of a core of countries that have very high credit ratings led by Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium. That they would, proceed to like very rapid economic and monetary integration, but then the other countries would sort of have other types of arrangements. So that's the two-track Europe. That's something that might gain more traction as this political chaos intensifies.
Okay, we will leave it there. We were joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. And we were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump yesterday demanded that U.S. allies, quote, fix trade, unquote, in the immediate aftermath of new tariffs on goods coming from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said that the U.S. and Canada were very near a renegotiated trade deal yesterday when Vice President Pence suddenly demanded that any new deal automatically expire after 5 years. The Canadians walked away. We're joined from Canada by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of the book Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back.
Good evening.
Jack, so what exactly are we looking at here? This looks to be a bona fide trade war in the making.
It's not a trade war yet. It may spin off into one, but you got to remember there's a two-track trade policy going on in the U.S. One is Trump policy strategy in relationship to America allies, and another is China, really quite different. If you look at what's going on with the allies here, things, as you even noted, were going quite well with NAFTA. And then all of a sudden, we have a shift by Trump. This is all part of tactical negotiations. You see, most people forget what is the domestic element in this trade negotiation. With Trump, the objective is to get something to boast about, exaggerate before the November elections, and to whip up his base to get them to believe he's doing something about America First, economic nationalism. Trump wants something better for U.S. Corporations, but I believe he will accept something relatively minor with regard to the allies. If you look at the response to, quote, the trade war and the latest move by Trump here, you see a rather tepid response by Canada and Europe. Yes, it's a quid pro quo, tit for tat. They announce some tariffs. Europe announced $7.5 billion. That's minuscule. Canada, given the fact that Canada is the biggest trade partner of the U.S., announced $16 billion in counter tariffs. Mexico, only $4 billion. This is just tactical. This is maneuvering going on here. You know, the U.S. has $2.5 trillion trade balance every year. So when you talk about $4 and $7 billion, I mean, this is insignificant. I think this is all tactical moves. And I think what you need to look at is the deal that the U.S. concluded with South Korea, which was a real softball deal. Korea, by the way, was the second largest steel importer to the U.S., and they got off totally. No tariffs on Korean steel imports. They're continuing. No tariffs on anything else. And just some minor quotas on autos. I think you're going to see something come out of this probably before the election in November, which the U.S. will agree with Europe, agree with NAFTA. But the details will be minor tweaks to existing trade. But Trump will then boast and exaggerate and lie about it and make a big deal to his base. I think that's what's going on with this particular trade war.
You know, nobody's really talking about that. I think Jack is right. I think this is all for show. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any diplomatic sense or national security sense to provoke the European Union, the Canadians, the South Koreans, the Mexicans. Over the long term, it's only a loss for us. I think he's right. I think he's playing to the base, and in the end, there is going to be a deal.
But then let's talk about the politics of it. There's the politics of his base, which I agree with you, John, and understand and agree with what Jack is saying. Nonetheless, it's sort of like taking an abrasive and rubbing it over the face of the key U.S. allies
without
and trading partners. I mean, it's like taking sandpaper and just wiping Germany and France and the UK's face with sandpaper. Doesn't feel good. Creates a lot of animus. Even if it's mainly theatrical, nobody knows exactly what it means because Trump has got so much bluster and bluff, and you never really know what Donald Trump's bottom line is. So it's an irritant, that isn't it, Jack, to primary U.S. relations?
Well, it's an irritant if the other parties don't understand Trump's method of operation. I think the Chinese do. I think they've got it figured out because they're making token concessions here. But I'm not sure that the other U.S. allies, because they are allies and this is so outrageous and strange to them, they really understand the way Trump operates. Now, when he was in business, he operated this very same way. He would throw out outrageous initial positions and sound very threatening. But then when they came to the table and started negotiations with him, he was controlling the agenda, and he had the psychological advantage because of his initial positions. And then he would play softball. He would back up right away. Well, he's negotiating this trade the same way he would negotiate his deals in commercial property. And I'm not so sure that his opponents, quote, the allies, really quite understand that. But if you look at the responses, as I mentioned, they're very tepid, minor responses by the Canadians and the Europeans. And if you look at what's been happening with trade since the beginning of this year, U.S. exports to these countries have been going up and the imports from these countries have been going down. You know, we even have a surplus now, a trade surplus with Canada. It doesn't make sense to go to war over trade with Canada, especially since half of U.S. steel and aluminum exports to Canada, or half of all U.S. exports of steel go to Canada. If you look at the details, it just doesn't make sense that this is a bona fide trade war here, particularly with the allies. This is politics before November. And also, I think Trump wants to pump up his domestic base to show he's doing something about trade, to mobilize them in case the Mueller decision comes down negatively here. It may come down before November, may come down afterwards. So this has a lot of domestic politics involved in it.
I'm looking at the headline, John, of the Global Times. Global Times is an interesting site. It's not the Communist Party of China, but it's largely understood to be to reflect the views of the leadership in China. The headline of today, the lead editorial, is "Time for EU to Rise Up Against U.S. Tariff Peril." Interesting choice of words. Certainly, China has... You know, there's two or three kinds of globalization going on. The U.S. is driving one part of globalization, and it's got its own project. China's, with the Belt and Road Initiative, has another kind of globalization. And some of the European Union countries, including these same countries, Germany, France, U.K., who the Obama administration warned them, don't be part of the Belt and Road, don't be part of the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, the Chinese-led bank that sort of rivals the U.S.-dominated banks and the IMF. China wants to strengthen its relations with these same countries. Maybe these same countries, even if it's largely theatrical, won't they start to move in a different direction? I mean, it's a lot of humiliation for political leaders in Europe, no?
Well, yes, of course. China's all over Europe trying to buy up companies, trying to extend trade deals with Europe. And now with the European economy stagnating once again, including Germany, the opportunity for deals with China in Europe are going to rise. And you point to an important psychological effect here, and that is even though the Europeans probably feel that they can come to a deal with the U.S., it does rankle them personally and undermines their authority, particularly Merkel in Germany, to have to deal with this kind of a strategy and approach by Trump. And of course, Trump may go too far with his nasty tweets, and he just may alienate these people enough in Canada and in Europe that they'll start looking elsewhere for some of their trade deals. And that's a risk in his strategy, you see. But what Trump really wants in the end is some better deal for U.S. corporations. And this isn't going to improve the welfare in terms of jobs or wages, real wages with inflation rising, of American workers. This is to tweak the global trade structure, to benefit U.S. corporations. This is what Reagan did with Japan and in the 80s, and this is what Nixon did with Europe in the 70s, but now it's kind of a China global thing with Trump, and I don't think he's going to be as successful.
Yeah, there's so much more to this than meets the eye. I think that there actually is a strategy here. I think that Trump is not winging it like so many people are saying. I think Jack Rasmus is right that there's an overall strategy. It's risky, and whether it works or not remains to be seen. But I think there's something there. Jack, we've got about 30 seconds left. I want to ask you real quickly, over the next, say, 6 to 12 months, is this going to have any impact on unemployment or on inflation, do you think?
Well, yes. If you got the rising dollar, first of all, and rising interest rates, which are going to continue in the U.S., that makes the U.S. Imports rise in price. You're going to, if some of these things actually get implemented, even in the short term, that's going to raise inflation in the U.S. and reduce real wages for workers in the U.S. It's going to cause job losses in certain sectors for the U.S. But the most important thing is the uncertainty that it brews, you see. And Trump is betting or trying to bet that his tax cuts will stimulate real investment and jobs in the U.S. This whole trade thing, uncertainty, and as it drags out past the elections, could undermine that. and you would end up in a recession in 2019, which I predict for a whole number of reasons, not just this trade factor.
And you're not alone. You're not alone in predicting that. We're going to have to end it there. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California, and author of the book Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
When 167 schools closed in Puerto Rico a little more than a year ago, it was a painful sign that the island's economy had not recovered from a long recession. But when another 265 schools closed soon after that, it sent the entire education system into a state of turmoil. Why does Puerto Rico's education system not function the way it should? We're joined from Bradenton, Florida by Ruth Beltran. She's an organizer with Black Lives Matter Tampa. Ruth, welcome back.
Thank you for having me today.
Ruth, it's easy and probably natural to blame this on Hurricane Maria, but we can't blame all of it on Hurricane Maria, can we? Why does the federal government ignore Puerto Rican education?
Yes, definitely we cannot blame everything on Hurricane Maria. I actually think that the governor is using the devastation from Hurricane Maria to implement privatization efforts that have actually been proposed for a number of years in Puerto Rico. And if we really look at what's happening, it's no coincidence that the announcement of the closures came only 2 weeks after Governor Rosello signed a bill implementing a charter school pilot program in Puerto Rico, where some of the funding that has been designated for public schools will now be going to private administered charter schools, basically private companies.
Yeah, that's a problem all over the island.
This has to be part of a federal government. I don't want to use the word conspiracy because it's not a hidden thing.
But it's a plan.
It's a plan. It's a plan. That's exactly what it is. Betsy DeVos went to New York City. She's the Secretary of Education. She only visited private schools. I mean, how do you do that? Go to New York City. And that was just a week ago. Go ahead, Ruth.
Yes. Well, we see this is really a part of the capitalist crisis that is going on now. We have seen the privatization of utilities. Now we see the privatization of schools. You know, really a full loom of taking private funds and putting it in the pockets of just a few investors. And the people in Puerto Rico really struggle with what are symptoms of capitalism and colonialism. This is not being done because the federal government cares about the people in Puerto Rico, or because they care about the education, or because there will be actual benefits, you know, a better education, education will be able to reach more children. We know that that is not the case. This is really just with the purpose of taking public funds and shifting it to the pockets of a few investors.
John, I'm looking at the New York Times about this. Here I'm going to read a couple sentences and then have Ruth respond, but I also, John, get your response. The unrest in Puerto Rico's educational system, where only 10% of 7th, 8th, and 11th graders achieved proficiency in a standardized math test last year, extends beyond the loss of schools. In March, the governor signed a law that for the first time will allow for the establishment of charter schools and vouchers. Charter schools are publicly funded, but independently, that is, privately run. Vouchers allow public money to be spent on private schools and have been criticized by opponents for draining money from public schools. The other thing about this is that the private schools or the charter schools, they can decide who to accept and who not to accept. If you have a student that has a problem not doing so well, you just get rid of that student. They have no obligation, unlike the public school system. It seems to me that here we have Puerto Rico, which is part of the United States, yes, on a colonialized basis, but nonetheless, legally part of the United States, and Puerto Ricans are legally U.S. citizens, and you have 10% of 7th, 8th, and 11th graders achieving proficiency in standardized math tests. I mean, that's not just a failure of those students or of their families. That has to be a systematic failure of an entire system. And since these kind of deficiencies are actually easily mediated or remediated. The fact that they're not also means, it seems to me, that there is a plan to allow Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican kids to fail, to make the point that public schools are a failure in order to justify this transfer of money to private school corporations.
That's right. It proves a conservative ideological point. Now, of course, it doesn't really, but the Republicans and the conservatives are going to point to this and say, this is why we need more charter schools, not fewer. We need to put more money in private education rather than public education. So it's a former boss of mine said, it's a self-licking ice cream cone. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is what they want to happen. And so they make it happen.
Go ahead, Ruth.
Correct. And it goes into the brainwashing of the masses of people, right? We need to give the impression that because public schools are so deficient, it justifies the shifting of funds into private pockets. And that really should not be the case. You know, this is going to result in a major re-traumatization of the kids in Puerto Rico. Now, parents who do not rely on private transportation or the parents that live in smaller towns are going to really not have access to education. I've been reading and researching about this, and some parents are reporting that they will not have a school within half hour of their town. Just imagine the impact that will have on the education and the literacy rate of kids and the access to public education, which is a right. It's a right. Every child and every, you know, children in every country should have access to public education. And Puerto Rican people are U.S. citizens. They should also have access just the way everyone in the mainland does to public education. And that is something that is going to be taken away. It's really going to take a toll on the suffering that the Puerto Rican people has been enduring for decades now. So it's really something that we have to pay attention to. And as we know, with the Secretary of Education that we have right here at home, you know, the purpose of the government now in this administration is to be able to shift those funds from public schools to private schools. You know, the promotion of charter schools is just immensely. We see a big impact of this. For example, I can give you Denver, where now most of the schools and most of the private funds that are designated for public schools are going into private schools. And this is affecting more and more states. You know, little by little, we see that shifting. And the kids are not benefiting. Our society as a whole is not going to see a benefit from this. It will have the complete opposite effect.
That's the voice of Ruth Beltran. We're talking to her about the closing or the announced closure of another 265 schools in Puerto Rico. Ruth, right now the teachers seem to be in the vanguard in many ways. The teachers' union, which is a union that's fought for social justice, not just higher wages or better benefits for teachers, although it's done that. It's also been fighting for Puerto Rico. The teachers are really leading the struggle under the banner saying no to privatization and yes to public schools. Talk about the union, if you could.
Oh, yes. The unions have done a great job. They are in complete opposition of the privatization of education. They have been in the streets protesting and demonstrating. I mean, they have really been leading the efforts to defend public education in the island. You know, they are there. They understand. They have regular contact with the kids. They understand what life is like for the students in Puerto Rico. And they are really leading the cause to defend public education in Puerto Rico. So I really applaud them for that. And I am very confident that the people of Puerto Rico, the teachers, the parents, and the students will have a win if they continue to protest and demonstrate and defend public education. And we here in the mainland will continue to support that.
Ruth Beltran is our guest. Ruth, we're talking to about the closure of 264 schools in Puerto Rico. Ruth, you know, hurricane season is almost upon us once again. In fact, it's here. It's coming a little bit earlier each year. I can't imagine what's going to happen if Puerto Rico, which is, you know, right in the center of so many hurricanes, takes another big hit this year. But it seems like, again, even though Puerto Rico is part of the richest country in the world, the biggest economy in the world, the most resources in the world. It's just living on the edge. I just wonder, what do you think is likely to happen? Again, we see a lot of migration taking place, people leaving the island.
And that's the key. It's actually a depopulation of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, a depopulation of an area where it's beautiful real estate. You know, eventually, as the schools are privatized, as what's left of the public sector is privatized, I think there's going to be a massive gentrification of non-Puerto Ricans coming into Puerto Rico. What do you think?
Oh, my goodness. And that is really the goal here. You know, if you look at what's happening in the plan, the privatization of everything, how every decision that this government makes really makes the life of the people of Puerto Rico more and more difficult, you know, in a way that they are making them run away from the island. And I speak to different Puerto Rican people, and they love the island. They do not want to leave. You know, they are used to their life over there, and they want to stay. But this government, with its different policies, continues to make their lives there more difficult. And this is going to continue as we see the closing of these schools. You know, parents will no longer have easy access to public education. And we can really expect more parents and families to leave the island, leaving it, you know, free for investors and others to come and just take advantage of the gem that Puerto Rico is and the resources that he offers.
That was the voice of Ruth Beltran. She's an organizer with Black Lives Matter Tampa. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Russell. Welcome back, both of you.
Delighted to be here.
Me too. Thanks.
Well, John, it's not just the worst and most misleading headlines. There's actually humorous headlines. Steve Pat, where should we start?
Well, I'll let you guess what category this headline falls into. Here's the headline. Trump, fast food lover and exercise avoider, tells nation about importance of fitness.
Oh, my God. Okay. What did he say? What's his advice about fitness? We know he's in good shape. We know that part.
Well, the doctors have told us that.
There were several funny things about the actual story, which was Trump. Most of the people he was talking with on this program at the White House were actually professional athletes, which is not what most people in the country can aspire to. What I found really funny in the story was this line about Trump's exercise regimen. Even when he golfs, Trump eschews walking, preferring to take a golf cart. That itself is not so abnormal. Even driving onto greens, which is normally frowned upon.
No, wait a second. That's not normally frowned on. That's a violation of all golf club etiquette and rules. He drives onto the greens with the golf cart? I mean, how do the greens will just be eaten up.
But not by Trump. He would never eat the greens.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if you were a member of a golf club, unless you owned the golf club, you would be thrown out of the golf club.
Oh, right. He owns the golf club.
But if you own the golf club, I guess it's okay, and you're a lazy son of a gun like apparently Trump is, based on his exercise regimen or lack thereof. Let's go to another headline. Again, I'll let you guess which category this one is in. Mattis says China is out of step with international law.
Do we have an irony category? Like really, really big ironies? Mattis says China is out of step with international law. And, you know, he's also upset that China keeps insisting that it's an Asian Pacific power. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. Well, of course, the U.S. insists that the U.S. is outside of international law. So that's really the only reason why we're not out of step with international laws. It doesn't apply to us.
When you create international law, how can you be outside of it?
Well, you know, it's funny. And on a serious note, though, John Kiriakou, you'll remember this, that since we're talking about this as a now serious matter, when the U.S. was brought before the International Criminal Court at The Hague for mining, that is putting bombs and explosives in the harbors in Nicaragua.
Oh, yes. I remember it well.
The ICC ruled 15-0 This is the International Criminal Court at The Hague ruled 15-0 that the U.S. was in violation of international law. And the U.S. said,
tough luck.
Yeah, exactly, tough luck. We don't care. You don't have any jurisdiction over us.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, telling China that it's out of step with international law. All right, let's go on to another headline.
I'm going to go to a bad headline, and this was actually one of my nominee for one of the worst headlines I've ever seen. It's from the BBC, and it reads, Syria war, Russians killed in militant raid in Deir el-Azur. Now, at first you might think that's not so out of the ordinary. After all, just last week we were complaining about the use of the word militant to describe the notorious terrorist Luis Posada Carriles in headlines. But why I single out this one is because the raid, which was being described in this article, was with ISIS, the most, you know, the existential threat to the entire world, if you believe, you know, the U.S. government and everyone else. So here we have Russians being killed by ISIS in a battle. And if ISIS had killed a Briton, someone in the United Kingdom or in the United States or France or anyone else, the headline would talk about terrorism. But if they kill Russians, that's okay. They're just militants.
That's disgusting. But, you know, like it would never even occur to headline writers in any of the U.S. corporate-owned media, or in the case of BBC, it's a state-owned media. If Americans or Brits were killed by ISIS, that they would call the attackers militants.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also fascinating because, you know, a lot of the time we don't even see headlines about Syrians, for example, getting killed in Syria, that it's not even written about in the news. And if we do see something about Russians killed, you've got this kind of crazy headline going on.
Militants. They're believers. Let's go to another headline.
Actually, what Nicole just said leads into the next headline, which is what I call a trick headline. And I'm going to read the headline. It's from RT. Freedom flotilla foiled. Israel blocks Palestinian attempt to leave Gaza by sea. And just briefly saying what the news story is about. This was a group of people in Gaza who were attempting to leave Gaza in a boat, or actually a group of boats. And some of them were people who had been injured in the recent Israeli assaults on the border protests. And a few of the others were people who had been denied permission to emigrate to get an education abroad because their jailers prevented them from leaving the jail. So what's wrong with that headline? Freedom flotilla foiled. Israel blocks Palestinian attempt to leave Gaza by sea.
Well, the alliteration is nice.
Yeah. The answer is there's nothing wrong with that headline. What's wrong is the fact that this headline did not appear, or anything similar to this headline, did not appear in the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, BBC, or any mainstream outlet I could find. In other words, this is a typical example of a story which is not being covered, and people do not know about it. And that kind of thing, the absence of coverage, can have just as meaningful influence on people's thinking as the other kind of headlines we're talking about, where headlines are misleading or bad and so on.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, and again, because RT and Sputnik, you know, these companies have been forced to register as foreign agents in the United States, in the Washington, D.C. area. You can no longer watch RT. It's not part of the cable package any longer. I mean, that's also true about some of the other international media. But as a consequence, people in the United States will not see, if they don't have access to this kind of alternative media, important stories. And there's the stories that are not covered. And then there's the other part of the way the media gets it wrong with its headlines is the kind of false neutrality or false objectivity. There was always called clashes between the Israelis and the Palestinians at the Gaza border, when in fact Israeli snipers were shooting thousands, literally thousands of unarmed people.
Well, 12,000 actually have been wounded, including many, many thousand who have been shot.
That's amazing. And again, people don't know because it's not in the headline. And a lot of times all that people read are the headlines. Steve, we only have a couple minutes left. Let's go to the next one.
Okay, this one is a story you covered a couple days ago, but I just want to point out a headline and a problem. And this is about the alleged murder, which turned out not to be the murder, of Arkady Babchenko in Ukraine. Here's the headline. Russian journalist faked death to foil murder plot. So again, so what's wrong with that headline? Well, what's wrong with that is one day after the media uncritically accepted the word of the Ukrainians that this Babchenko had been killed, they are now uncritically accepting the word that there was a Russian plot that existed and it was foiled by this fake death. So they don't seem to, it's a classic case of fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me.
That's an excellent point, because the media all reported that Babchenko was dead and that Putin probably killed him, the Russians probably killed him. And then he shows up at this press conference and guess what? I'm not dead. I'm here. I'm in the flesh. But I was just doing it. I faked this death. I tricked all of you in order to catch the potential murderers. And that's what the Ukrainian government did. And you're right, Steve. This headline, Russian journalist faked death to foil murder plot. They couldn't believe him, shouldn't have believed him one day. And they're still believing him because it's still part of that anti-Russian narrative.
Exactly.
Okay, 60 seconds left. Last headline.
Since we're on Russia, I'll go with this one. At Trump Tower, Michael Cohen and oligarch discussed Russian relations. That's a headline from the New York Times. What's wrong with that? Well, the headline conveniently admits the fact that the meeting was after the election. So they kind of imply to the reader that this was related to the so-called collusion story. But of course, there's nothing meeting with someone after the election. There's nothing wrong with that.
And also, you're only an oligarch if you're billionaires who are Russian are oligarchs. But billionaires like Trump, I mean, wouldn't that be oligarchs meet at Trump Tower?
Joining us from San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And we were joined in the studio by Sputnik News producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.